Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
From Radio.com and the radio home of the New York Mets, WCBS News Radio 880. It's Books on Deck. Now, locked up in his home in the middle of America, waiting to hear those words, play ball again. From the radio play-by-play team of the New York Mets, it's Wayne Randazzo.
Thank you very much, Steve Scott. Welcome back to Books on Deck on WCBS 880. I'm Wayne Randazzo, and this week we will talk to Ralph Carhart, a New York City native who wrote a book called Haul Ball. And it is an interesting book because it is about a baseball that Ralph takes all over the country and even in some other countries to have a picture taken with it by every single Hall of Famer, and not just every living Hall of Famer. He actually visits the graves of every passed away Hall of Famer. And, you know, it's a little bit on the unusual side for sure, but it's an interesting story, and we'll talk to Ralph about that in just a little bit. Ralph, by the way, is an educator at Queens College, the alma mater of one Howie Rose. Meanwhile, baseball seemingly just around the corner, aiming for a July 24th opening day for the Mets. So we are getting there, and hopefully this will all happen. Obviously, there's a lot to have go right for baseball to get through an entire season. Even if it's this short of a season, there's still a lot that has to be done correctly for baseball to be able to push through this. So they're trying, and hopefully we'll have some games to broadcast very soon. Meanwhile, we won't have very many of these episodes left. I think I'm going to do one more next week, and then we'll call it a wrap for Books on Deck. Hope you've enjoyed what you've heard so far. This week's episode is brought to you by Berklee College. Be inspired, be supported, and be marketable. Prepare for some of today's most in-demand career fields in New York, New Jersey, or online at Berklee College, where your potential is our promise. Learn more at berkleecollege.edu. And by the Rothenberg Law Firm, we spend a lot of time talking and worrying about injuries to our favorite players, but they have access to the best medical care and don't have to worry about going into financial struggles. For the rest of us, an injury can affect our very way of life. So if you're injured, it's important you do not go through this process without a strong law firm on your side. For over 50 years, the Rothenberg Law Firm has won billions in injury verdicts and settlements for families. For more, go to www.injurylawyer.com. Well, let's get on with this week's episode as we talk to Ralph Carhart about his book, The Haul Ball. All right, now we bring in the author of The Haul Ball. Ralph Carhart is a longtime Mets fan. He's a member in the Sabre community. Of course, the Society of American Baseball Research is what that stands for. So we are happy to have Ralph join us here to talk about his book, The Haul Ball. Ralph, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me with you tonight.
Ralph, this is an interesting sort of project that you took on upon yourself. You said it was about 10 years ago when you started this, and, you know, just on a trip up to Cooperstown, and this is just kind of how these things sort of begin. What is the Haul Ball, and why was this an important thing for you to go after?
The Haul Ball was an idea that I came up with about 10 years ago, like you said, on a trip to Cooperstown. My wife and I made two discoveries on that particular trip. The first was a baseball that she found laying in the small creek that runs next to Double A Field there in Cooperstown. And the second thing that we found was a gravestone. We're genealogists, so we spend a fair amount of time in cemeteries. And we were in the cemetery in Cooperstown doing some poking around, and we found a gravestone for Abner Doubleday. Now, it wasn't our Abner, the mythological creator of baseball. It turned out that it was his grandfather. Our Abner is actually buried in Arlington National Cemetery down in Virginia. But it was, you know, it was his name in stone, and those two elements together sparked an idea in me to take a baseball, that baseball that we found, to all of the members of the Baseball Hall of Fame, both living and deceased. And if they were alive, I was going to take a picture of them holding the ball. And if they were no longer with us, I was going to take a picture of the ball at their grave. And I spent 8 years doing that and wrapped that up about a year and a half ago.
You know, John Thorne, the great baseball historian, maybe the number one baseball historian, says your book is oddly touching, and I think he means the fact that you go through these grave sites, and there is a morbidity to it, and there is, you know, that finality of visiting these legendary graves, as it were. I mean, all the way from Babe Ruth to maybe people that aren't as well known, guys like Henry Chadwick and some of these names. When you look at the Baseball Hall of Fame list, and you're like, I've never heard of these people, but there are some great 19th century figures certainly in the Hall of Fame that you had to track down, guys who've been in that ground for quite a long time.
Yeah, it was John. You mentioned John, and he's been a huge supporter of the project for years now. I met him, funny enough, in 2014 because the very first grave that I visited belonged to a gentleman by the name of Saul White. As you say, not one of the more well-known names in the Hall of Fame pantheon, but he was a towering figure in the world of the Negro Leagues. And I visited him first because at the time I was living in Staten Island, and that's where he's buried. And I got to his grave and discovered that he didn't have a stone. I quickly learned through my research that there were a small handful, about three Hall of Famers, all of them not coincidentally Negro Leaguers, who didn't have stones. And I met John because I reached out to a Sabre group called the Negro Leagues Baseball Grave Marker Project, and I worked with them to get a stone for Saul White placed on his grave in Staten Island. And when we successfully did that, we had a dedication ceremony, and I invited John to attend, and he did. And he came and spoke about what Saul meant to baseball and how important the work of the Negro League Baseball Grave Marker Project was. And, we built a friendship from there. But, you know, Saul was one of those 19th century guys. He lived until the 20th century, but he played in the 19th century. And there were a number of those old timers who were, you know, on my travels. And you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that there are a number of Hall of Famers that most people haven't heard of. You could take the most ardent baseball fan, and, you know, they'll be lucky to name 100 of the 330 names that are enshrined in the Baseball Hall of Fame. So part of the whole goal of the project was to bring these names from yesteryear that people didn't know and sort of look at them with an equal amount of reverence as the Babe Ruths and the Ty Cobbs.
Yeah, I wonder too if the average fan is listening and saying, "Well, how do you even meet all these guys? Where do you go to find Raleigh Fingers or Goose Gossage or George Brett?" And the answer usually is card shows. These guys are out making money and getting paid to sign their autographs, you know, pretty frequently. Well, at least at one point in time, maybe not anymore. Card shows are certainly a thing of the past, and maybe they'll come back in the future. But, you know, for those old timers that were looking for some extra paychecks, that was a good way to get their autographs and to meet them. And I'm assuming that, and I know from reading some of the book, that's how you got to meet a lot of these guys. Did you have to go into the backstory each time when you saw some of these Hall of Famers, when you approached Gaylord Perry or whoever you went up to?
When I first started approaching the living guys, and I waited about a year, I spent a year just visiting the graves to make sure I was going to remain dedicated enough to actually follow this project all the way through to the end before I started putting the effort in to reach the living guys. And when I first started meeting up with them, and you're right, it was primarily at baseball card shows, and I went to Cooperstown every induction weekend over the life of the project, and I got a bunch of them in Cooperstown. But when I first started that very first time, I didn't tell them the story. I just asked for the picture, and they let me have it. As the project progressed, I sort of felt like I owed it to the players to tell them what they were getting involved in. And so I came up with a quick 20-second version of the story that I could explain to them as I was putting the ball in their hands and asking to take their pictures. And some of them thought it was really cool. I got some, Pedro Martinez and Jim Tomei and Wade Boggs. Those guys gave me some great, feedback. And like, that sounds really fun. Nice job. Keep going. There were other players who were more apprehensive. I wasn't asking for a signature. There are no autographs on the ball. That's an important thing to establish. I did that for two reasons. The first was just logistics. There's like 75 living Hall of Famers, and there's not room on a baseball for 75 signatures. But the other part of it had to do with, just as you were talking about, signatures for these guys, especially the older players who've retired and done the baseball card shows and are doing the baseball card shows for a secondary income, signatures are a commodity, and I was trying my best to create something that wasn't a commodity. I was trying to make an artifact, as it were. Some of them were apprehensive just because they didn't understand why I didn't want the autograph. A couple of them were outright defensive about it.
Why? What could be the reason for that?
I think it was because I was asking for something different. I was asking for something that...
Who gave you the most trouble?
Who gave me the most trouble? Well, I had to ask Bob Gibson three times. he's the only one I had to ask three times. I had to ask Randy Johnson twice.
Yeah.
But Bob Gibson was the only one I had to ask for three times. And I can't guess as to why Bob Gibson was resistant to it. I'm not exactly sure. He didn't give me his reasons, and I didn't pester him when he said no. He was of a small handful. There weren't very many who were outright defensive about it. It was, three or four. Most of them were just willing to take the picture and let this weird guy get on with his day.
it's one thing, I think, as far as visiting the grave sites of the Hall of Famers, to go to Pittsburgh and to see Josh Gibson. I mean, that's something cool that I think baseball fans, I think, all can relate to. But, you end up in, like, Moline, Illinois, visiting the grave of Warren Giles. Was there any point where you're like, what am I doing here in the middle of America visiting a grave site of someone that, I'm not sure four people can even name?
Yes. There were times that happened. I'm not going to deny it. There were times that it happened. Usually, over the course of the project, I got three speeding tickets.
It's a lot less than I would have gotten.
The project, between flying and driving, the project was 48,000 miles. I spent 24,000 miles in the air and 24,000 miles on the ground. I got some speeding tickets along the way. And usually after, I got one of those, it was saying to myself, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? it was even, the ones who did not elicit the thrill, like a Warren Giles in Moline, Illinois, it's still... the ones that did mean something, the ones that did have a powerful impact, made it all worth it in the end, for sure. And I have to be honest, by the end of the project, because it wasn't easy getting those living guys, and it was, usually a tough situation for me, I was much happier to be chasing after the dead guys than the living ones. The dead guys stayed put, and nobody told me no. so it was more enjoyable going for them by the end, quite frankly.
You of course come across some Mets players. Moline, Illinois, by the way, one of the Quad Cities. When you do come across some Mets and ex-Mets as you go along in this, and of course you come across an old Mets broadcaster, just because of the timing of your book and when this project started, Ralph Kiner was still alive, and he was still someone that you could go and meet and take a picture with, and you were able to do that near the end of Ralph's life. What was that like for you as a longtime Mets fan to meet Ralph and to have him take a picture with the ball?
Ralph was particularly special because of my Mets fandom, because of the circumstances. He was doing an appearance. It was an induction weekend in 2011, and he was doing an appearance in a CVS drugstore with Bobby Doerr. So, you know, you had Ralph, who I believe was in his mid to high 80s at that point, and Bobby Doerr, who was in his low 90s. You were looking at 150 years of baseball experience sitting in a couple of chairs in front of you. So, you know, that alone was an awe-inspiring experience. But, you know, Ralph was the voice I listened to going to sleep at night when I was a kid. You know, I was a Mets fan. I've been a Mets fan since 1984, and I, you know, was listening to Bob and Ralph every night. So to have a chance to sort of meet him face to face was powerful in the moment itself, and it gained extra significance because Ralph ended up being the first Hall of Famer that I photographed while they were alive, who passed before I was done with the project. Over the life of the project, I think there were about 8 or 9 Hall of Famers that I had a chance to photograph them while they were alive, but then they died before I was done. So when Ralph died, that was, believe it or not, the first moment that it really occurred to me that this baseball that I was in the process of making was, as of that very moment, irreplaceable. I was never going to be able to take another baseball and bring it to all of the graves and have a picture of Ralph Kiner holding it. That was not a thing I was ever going to be able to do again. And that realization was really a powerful one for me, and it was special to me that it was Ralph who sort of sparked that.
You mentioned that sort of juxtaposition between the, you know, the players that were still alive and maybe didn't make it long enough for you to get to them, or, you know, we certainly have talked about the guys who were long past. But, you know, Gary Carter passed away in the process. You mentioned your Mets fandom kicks in 1984. Well, that's right around the time, you know, a little bit before Gary Carter becomes a Met and helps lead them to the World Series in 86. He passes away of cancer while you're making this book, but you did say that you did have one chance to get that picture with the kid, and unfortunately just didn't happen for you.
It didn't. It was Gary Carter's my greatest project-related regret. Like I said, I didn't actually attempt to reach the living guys during that first year. I had a chance to get Gary in that first year. There was a baseball card show that was happening, fairly local to me. And I went to it, and I considered it, and there was this giant long line, and I still hadn't decided. I was trying to figure out a way to do this without paying the money. You know, that was one of the advantages. Is what I ultimately ended up doing was talking to the promoters of the various baseball card shows, and they gave me essentially backstage access to get the greater majority of these pictures. The travel alone, I had to go to 34 states, Puerto Rico, and Cuba to complete the project, and funny enough, I had to go to Cuba twice. So, you know, the travel alone was a steep bill to pay for the project, and to add on top of it 75 autograph fees for living guys was a thing I was trying to avoid. So I didn't really know when Gary was making that appearance, I didn't really know how to go about it just yet. And it was the next baseball card show that came through town that I had the realization that what I needed to do was to talk to the promoters of the baseball card show and see how they could help me. And from there, the process of reaching out to the living Hall of Famers got rolling. But Gary was sort of a prologue to all that. And I didn't get the picture that day. And I had thought that he was young, that Gary, you know, if it had been Bobby Doerr that day, I might have paid the, you know, whatever it was, $80 and stood in the line. But I remember having the thought that Gary Carter was young. He'd just been elected a couple of years earlier. He was going to be around, and I was going to have a second chance to get him, and I didn't. And that, like I said, that remains the greatest regret I have for the entire project.
There's not every past Hall of Famer is entombed somewhere. There are certainly guys who have been cremated. Of course, Roberto Clemente stands out as someone who died tragically in the middle of water. So it was not like you could go to everybody's grave that had passed away. What ideas did you come up with to try to at least include some of those Hall of Famers that are not in a grave and are not alive?
Yeah, there's about 18, 19 of them who chose to be cremated after they passed. And what I decided to do for them was a series of symbolic pictures. And sometimes the symbolic pictures were relatively easy to think of. Bill Veeck, the great famous owner Bill Veeck, and Mickey Cochran, when they died, they were cremated and had their ashes spread in Lake Michigan. So I went to the shores of Lake Michigan and I took a picture there. For Clemente, I went to the shores of the beach in Puerto Rico where his airplane went down. I took a picture there. But there were some that I needed to think even further outside the box. One of my most favorite ones was Al Barlick, who was an umpire from the 40s, 50s. And Al got his start. Very first games Al ever called was for his company team. He was a miner in Springfield, Illinois, and he called games for the mining team, the company mining team. And so to honor him, I found the last surviving physical structure of the mine that he used to work on, and I took a picture of the ball at that mine. I chose a variety of paths in honoring the ball players who decided to be cremated when they died.
We're talking to Ralph Carhart, who is a Sabre member who has written a book called The Hall Ball, where he basically tracked down every member of the Hall of Fame, dead or alive, to take a picture with this ball, either at their grave sites or, as he just mentioned, some of the other areas where they had either statues erected or had some fame in a certain spot. But when you think about the Hall of Fame itself, Cooperstown, you know, the great museum there, all of what goes into Cooperstown. Have you reached out to the Hall of Fame? Have they discussed this with you at all? Were they helpful in any way?
I reached out to the Hall of Fame very early on in the project to ask them if there was any assistance they could give me in connecting with the living Hall of Famers, and they explained that they couldn't. They have very strict privacy policies that does not allow them to sort of ask those sorts of things for Hall of Famers, and I respect that. One of the interesting things that I didn't mention about the project itself is that it was my intention all along when I finished it to donate it to the Hall of Fame. I didn't want to go through all the trouble of making this thing and then just sort of stick it on a shelf in my office. I wanted people to see it. So it was my intention to donate it to the Hall of Fame when I was done. And like I said, I spoke with their sessions committee very early on, and they told me I was sort of on my own. About three quarters of the way through the project, I was actually, again, I was in Cooperstown for induction weekend, and Jeff Idelson, the then president of the Hall of Fame, was standing in line for coffee at the Stagecoach Cafe, and I went up to him and said, "Have you heard of this?" And he did, and he invited me to come to his office the next day, and we had a great chat, and he offered me support. He couldn't give me direct access to any of the Hall of Famers, but he did say that for any of the living Hall of Famers that I was still trying to reach, I could certainly use his name in the letter. I could write a letter and say Jeff Idelson is aware of the project and supports it, which I thought was very kind of him. That was great. But in the end, the Hall of Fame actually did not actively help me get any of the photos, nor did, frankly, any of the teams in Major League Baseball. I reached out to them in multiple ways. The San Francisco Giants, two of the photos that I struggled to get at the end were Willie Mays and Willie McCovey. And I was also struggling to get Nolan Ryan. So I sent multiple communications to the San Francisco Giants and the Houston Astros trying to make that happen, and it never did. In the end, all of the photos either came from me or a few other people. Along the way, there were some fans that the Hall Ball picked up, and one of them in particular helped me get the photos of Bill Mazeroski and Red Shane Deans. They were doing appearances that I couldn't make it to, but I gave the ball to this gentleman who's by the name of Tony Melito, who went and got those pictures. I owe him a huge debt, but in the end, the pictures are pretty much just me.
Where's the ball now?
Well, in the end, not to spoil the end of the book, but in the end, the Hall of Fame did not accept my donation. They gave me a number of reasons, and I'll let you read the book to find out what those reasons are. So I decided instead to donate it to an organization that is vastly different from the Hall of Fame. It's an organization out in California called the Baseball Reliquary, and it is a library located at Whittier College, which has a baseball studies program, and the library there is very specifically designed around helping those students furthering their studies. But it also has some museum type artifacts in it as well, unusual things. Like, for example, Doc Ellis's hair curlers, you know, unusual stuff like that. And I, as I was thinking about what to do with the ball after the Hall of Fame rejected it, I realized that, you know, I think one of the reasons the Hall of Fame rejected it is because it's super weird, right? Like, this isn't a normal thing that people do. I didn't know if, you know, I think the Hall of Fame didn't know what to do with something that odd. The Hall of Fame is a very reverential place, and the ball is different. And because of that, I thought that the Baseball Reliquary and their unique way of looking at the game was a nice fit, and that's where it is now.
Everyone knows that New York and Chicago have put together a long list of Hall of Famers over the years. Those are the two cities that have the most. The city that has the third most is one that I don't think anybody would really know. Maybe you know now because of all the studying you've done, but Mobile, Alabama has produced five Hall of Famers. They're all still alive. You didn't have to go to Mobile to visit any graves. Hank Aaron.
Except Satch. I don't think Satchel's still alive.
That's right. Satchel Paige is not. Right. He might still be pitching somewhere, actually. You don't really know. But, yeah, Hank Aaron, Ozzie Smith, Willie McCovey, Billy Williams, and Satchel Paige, as you mentioned, all from there. Double Duty Radcliffe is from there, too, but he's not in the Hall of Fame. He probably should be.
He's not. We'll see. There's been the Hall of Fame has been making some noise about, even though they said back in, I think it was 2006, that they weren't putting anyone else from the Negro Leagues in there. There's been some recent rumblings about relooking at that policy. And, you know, I think especially in light of the newfound racial awareness that America seems to be going through right now, you might see the Hall of Fame look at the candidates from the Negro Leagues one more time.
But, you know, aside from some of those interesting facts, what are some things you learned on this trip and on these voyages to all these states and in some cases other country to learn about this book and to put it together?
You know, I learned one of the recurring lessons that I learned was that many of the myths that we think of as baseball history aren't. The stories that surround baseball always have some kernel of truth, but the real truth is always something much more complicated. And two of the examples that I mentioned in the book are the stories of Ty Cobb and Rogers Hornsby, who have over in recent years, decades, been painted in a very racist light. And there's reasons for that, for sure. Rogers Hornsby was on the rolls of the KKK, right? So there's reason for that. But the men themselves actually seem to be far more complicated than that. We're now learning now, there was a recent book that came out recently called A Terrible Beauty about Ty Cobb, which calls into question a lot of the accusations that Al Stump made in Ty Cobb's book, in his book about Ty Cobb. And when I got to Royston, where Ty Cobb was born and is buried, I saw a town that worships him. And we all worship our you know, local sons, right? We always overlook the sins of our local sons when they do good out there in the world. But what he did for that community far extends just adulation for what he accomplished on the baseball field. You know, there's the entire hospital network in Royston, Georgia was financed by him. He sent hundreds of children to kids from Georgia to college. Ty Cobb was very, very wealthy when he passed, and only partly because of the money he made in baseball, mainly because he was a really wise investor. But he used that money for so much good that, you know, I learned that there was a very different person buried in that mausoleum in Royston, Georgia than I thought I knew when I began.
With obviously the Hall of Fame is an evolving place. It's going to keep inducting people every year. Do you need to go find Larry Walker now? Do you want to continue that with people, or do you feel like anything inside of you that says you probably should, that it would feel like an incomplete project if you don't keep going?
I knew back at the beginning that I was, in essence, making a project that could, in theory, have no end. And I didn't know what I was going to do about that back at the beginning. I figured I'd figure that out as I went along, and I did. For me, the project ended in 2018, and that class. If, you know, you ask me this question again in 10 years or 15 years or maybe after I retire, I might change my answer. I might call the Baseball Reliquary and see if they'll let me have it back so I can chase down, you know, what's happened in the last 15 years. But as of right now, I'm content with what I've made. And I'm happy to let it exist as it is.
Ralph, how can people find your book and get in touch with you about your project?
They can get the book through any book seller. You know, the obvious one is Amazon. But if you want to support independent bookshops, you can either go directly to my publisher, which is McFarlaneBooks.com, or you can go to the website for the Pandemic Baseball Book Club. I'm fortunate. I've joined a group of about 24 other authors, all who had books that were coming out right about now, and all of us are trying to figure out how to sell a baseball book when most of the normal methods that are available to you to sell a baseball book are not available. And we formed this collective of authors who are sort of helping each other out. We're spreading each other's messages. We're interviewing each other. We're writing stories and helping use our social media networks to spread our net. And we have a bookshop on our website where you can also purchase the book. Again, that's the Pandemic Baseball Book Club. The web address is pbbclub.com. And if you go to that, you can get the book there too.
Okay, Ralph Carhart is a New York City native. He works at Queens College, which, of course, is the alma mater. I think Howie graduated of Howie Rose. Just kidding. Of course he did. And I know that Howie will get a kick out of this book and that the Queens College kid wrote it.
I'm sure Howie will. Let Howie know, because I work in the Department of Drama, Theater, and Dance. His daughter used to be one of our students. I recall when his daughter was there. So,
Alyssa, I would assume that, you know.
Yes.
All right, Ralph Carhart. Ralph, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Wayne. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you again to Ralph Carhart for joining me this week to talk about The Hall Ball. You know, it's different, that's for sure, and I think it's a fun read. It's an interesting one just to see the lengths, I think, that Ralph went to go visit all these grave sites and even track down the players that are living and to have this picture taken with the baseball that had made it through every single Hall of Famer. So pretty cool idea and good follow through by Ralph. And I hope that you have a chance to take a look at his book, The Hall Ball, which is out now and you can get at anywhere books are sold. We'll have another episode next week. And in the meantime, we will hope that baseball will be even closer to coming back when we return for next week's episode. I'm Wayne Randazzo. This has been Books on Deck on WCBS 880.